All now take your seats again, and we'll come to the pièce de résistance. So that's what you always call the act before closing, is always the pièce de résistance, and I'm the closing act later, so that's all right. I've never had the opportunity to hear the gentleman who is our speaker for the second portion of this meeting. I have heard many things about him, and most of the things that I've heard have been good. I won't tell you any of the other things, because that's entirely up to him whether he wants to admit them or not. It's been our pleasure to have Father Joe M. from Baltimore, Maryland, as our speaker tonight. Father Joe.
I want to thank you for getting me out of the home tonight. Actually, I flew here from, strange enough, Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I was there last night. But when a plane landed at Orange County today, the pilot just jammed on the brakes and reversed the engines, and that thing just shook and shuddered to a stop right smack splat at the edge of the runway. And he was chalk white and the sweat spilling out of him. He said, "My God, I've never seen a runway so short." And the co-pilot said, "You ought to see how wide it is." You know what's frightening about being up here is it's pitch black out there. And there's always that fear of when and where will the rocks come from, you know. But please let me tell you a story that I heard from one of our patients. The best stories I know have come from our patients. But this is about a man who had no ears. He was born without ears. And he used to interview job applicants for his firm. So, of course, first question he would ask would be, "Do you know anything peculiar about me?" And whoever said, "Well, of course you have no ears," he'd give him short shrift. He'd kind of get rid of them. So this one fellow, as he's leaving, he got a hold of the man behind him. He said, "For heaven's sake, when you go in there, don't mention the fact this guy has no ears." "Sorry." So he went in. Sure enough, he got the question, "Do you notice anything peculiar about me?" So I said, "Yeah, you're wearing contact lenses." He said, "How in the hell do you know that?" The guy said, "If you had ears, you'd be wearing glasses." It reminded me of what I'm going to do right now. I just figured I used to say I'd tell stories in the beginning because I'd rather see smiles than stares. God, I can't see anything. But for those of you who have wondered, I am an alcoholic. And it's a tremendous privilege to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, I've talked publicly all my life, from the time I was in the eighth grade, actually. It's the way I got a scholarship to go to a Jesuit high school, or I'd never have gotten there. And I taught all my life. So when people ask me, "Do you get nervous before you speak?" And there's always someone who asks that wherever I go to give a lecture. And my standard answer is a very truthful one. No, I'm not nervous. It's what I do, it's what I love, it's what I enjoy. And to be able to communicate and to pass on to other people what came my way is a tremendous blessing. But to speak at an AA meeting is one of the most awesome responsibilities that I can think of. And right now I'm not so much nervous. I just feel warm here. It's just scared. You always ask yourself, will you say the right thing? Will you say it in the right way? Will your whole life be told the way you want it told? I am an alcoholic, and that's a central fact of my life. Everything revolves around that. When I went into treatment, the man who saved my life told me and all the other priests at Guest House, he said, "Fathers, Your sobriety comes before everything, including your priesthood. And one of them said, what do you mean by that? He said, if your sobriety doesn't come first, there won't be anything to come second. But the big book gives us instructions on how to tell our stories. They should disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. You know, I have a PhD in taking people's inventories. I'm good at it. I clock speakers, I really do. I clock the amount of time you dedicate to your sick years and the amount of time you dedicate to your recovery. I think I have a pretty good notion of your present condition. Yes, we should share our drinking, of course, so that we might identify, so that others might identify with us. But I come to AA to find out how to get well, to find out what you're doing, how you work your program. Please don't tell me that you can't talk about what saved your life for as long a time as you talk about your sick years. So I'll just tell you enough about my drinking to let you know and to let me know that I belong here. If any of you showed up tonight to hear the lurid details of the drinking priest's past, you may as well go home now. I just wasn't that good being that bad. And if I told you everything about my drinking, it'd put you to sleep. Put me to sleep often enough. I drank for 10 years, and the first 5 were comparatively trouble-free. No problem. I drank from age 24 to 34. But I learned very early in treatment that what makes trouble is trouble. And if you can connect drinking with any of your problems, you have a drinking problem. I bought that. My friends, I was not in denial for the last 2 years of my drinking. I knew exactly what was wrong with me. I just didn't know what to do about it. When I was first ordained, I was sent out to Mountain View, California. I was in seminary work. I taught seminarians of high school age. And Mountain View is about 40 miles south of San Francisco. It was in the lovely Santa Clara Valley. Beautiful there. And I was introduced to the martini on Thanksgiving Day of 1948. Now, it was an instant love affair. I didn't have to learn to drink martinis. I loved them. But you know, even in the beginning, I could never understand why people drank too much. My father did. I just couldn't understand how people, or why people would do that. Because I figured it was all by choice. I had absolutely no notion of compulsion or addiction or any of those words that characterize our drinking. Till it began to happen to me. Well, you know, one of the first indications that I was in trouble with my drinking was when I was spoken to about it by my superior. The very first time he ever came out, of course, it was his job by law. He had to go around to the various houses under his jurisdiction, interview the faculty, and then he would always make an individual visit with each man on the faculty. And he just made it known that he had heard rumors that when I was home in Baltimore the previous summer that I had been drinking a little bit. And he said, is that true? And I said, yes, Father, it is. And it was the only time, I believe, I ever told him the truth about my drinking. I remember once I was called in during the last year of my drinking. It was just before the Christmas holidays. And he put me in the hospital over the holidays to keep me from drinking. I'll never forget Christmas afternoon as long as I live. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was looking out the window at the lawn, wondering, what in the name of God am I doing here on a Christmas day? But when he called me in on the 20th, after the small talk was over, he said, have you been drinking? He didn't mean at the moment, but have you been drinking all along? No, Father. I knew I was lying. He knew I was lying. And I knew he knew it, and I couldn't say yes. I believe that that is the most self-degrading thing any human being can do. You know how serious a lie is? It's a prostitution of the mind. And to stand in front of somebody else who knows the truth, and you know he knows it, and to degrade yourself to that degree. Whatever it is that makes you do that has to be serious. And it was my drinking that made me do that. I didn't lie because I was evil. I lied for survival. If I'd told him the truth, he'd have told me to do something about it. That's why we lie, because we can't not lie. We drank because we couldn't not drink. The progression of my drinking was very gradual. I was spoken to about my drinking several times, but as a few of the years wore on out of St. Joseph's, my nerves got the better of me and I had to be hospitalized. I got out of the hospital. By the way, the doctor who took care of me, I didn't know him before, haven't met him since. His name, he was a very wise man, and his name went along with it, Dr. Solomon, and he was a beautiful man. He was a man who should have been a doctor, but he didn't know anything about alcoholism, he told me that. But he never used the word, alcoholism. He just presumed I wouldn't drink again. He spoke to me about hobbies, and one day, in a beautifully gentle way, he said to me, Father, suppose somebody came to you with a problem that you couldn't handle, or you just didn't have the answer to, what would you do? I said, I'd try to find it. He said, suppose you couldn't find it. I said, well, I'd get his permission to pose it to some expert that I knew did know something about it. Well, he said, that's the way I feel. He said, would you be willing to see a psychiatrist? I said, of course. By the way, I was one of the few people, not to the man he wanted to send me to, but I went to a psychiatrist one time and told him the truth. Many people go to psychiatrists and lie. I told the truth. God, I wanted an answer. I wanted help. But anyway, he recommended a psychiatrist. But before I could go, I was released from the hospital and went back to St. Joseph's. But the day that I was released from the hospital, this friend of mine, Father Larry Taylor, came down to get me, and we went to one of the lovely restaurants in San Francisco, and I had the 3 double martinis before dinner, and it never occurred to me not to. 10 days later, I was on an airplane being flown back east. You know the significance of that? This was a school year, and I was a teacher. 3 men had to pick up my courses and finish them. Now, why all the detail about that? Simplest reason on earth. Never in my entire life have I been transferred 3,000 miles with 3 other people picking up my responsibility as a teacher. Because of French fried potatoes. It was alcohol that did that. Alcohol that did that. God, the obvious becomes so obvious when somebody kicks us in the head with it. Austin Ripley, the man who saved my life, the fellow who founded Guest House, he said, look at the major problems of your life. Has the bottle been in the pitcher before, during, or after? If your answer is yes, sign up, Bunky, you're in. It's so simple, you know. It is so simple. Well, some of the tiny little indications. Number one was being spoken to about my drinking. Number two is lying about my drinking. Number three, being transferred because of my drinking. Being threatened in a gentle way because of my drinking. When I came back to Baltimore, those 2 years before I got into treatment were the 2 most miserable years of my life. I tried to quit and discovered that I couldn't. And the only thing that alleviated the terror of that realization was a little bit more of what caused it. Let me show you the brilliance of the man who saved my life. This won't take long. It's just a little bitty card. It's a verbal photograph of our souls. The paradox of the alcoholic. The alcoholic, of course, is many things, as we all know. He is the world's supreme paradox. He drinks not because he would, but because he must. He drinks not for pleasure, but to pain, yet he drinks. He will mortgage the wealth of the future to pay off the debts of the past so that he may drink up the non-existent present. He is the only one in nature, I think, who seeks stimulation in a sedative, only to find that it acts upon his nerves as excited misery. He seeks to inflate his puny little ego in the provocative wine of Bacchus and succeeds in shriveling his soul in the bitter gall of remorse. He escapes desperately to free himself from the facts of reality and runs headlong into the prison of fantasy. Success is just as fatal as failure to the alcoholic. He will drink with exhilaration to success and to sadness and misfortune. He drinks to get high in the evening, knowing how low he will be in the morning. When the alcoholic smilingly gets to the first drink he can get, he is transported to heaven. And when he is unable to get the last drink he can pour, he is transported to hell. The alcoholic, like most people, thrills to the beauty of life, and then how frequently he seeks the ugliness of existence. When he is sober, he craves to be drunk. When he is drunk, he prays to be sober. Such is the weird paradox of the alcoholic that the only way in which he can feel better is to drink that which makes him feel worse. He starts out on his drinking, no matter who he is, with all the dignity of a king, and winds up his drinking like a clown. So he goes his incredible, incomprehensible, paradoxical way, leaving in his wake his human wreckage, that which he does cherish most. Down the road of alcoholic oblivion, he stumbles and staggers until he either finds himself at the door of AA or death intervenes. Father McDonald sat me down one day with tears in his eyes. He said, "Son, you cannot continue to drink and teach seminarians. They don't go together. What is it that you want? If it is humanly available, it is yours, if it'll help you stop drinking." And I just sat there looking at him. I didn't know what to say. You see, he didn't have the answer either, but he desperately wanted to help me. And I just kept getting worse inside. Ladies and gentlemen, I truly believe that God did not hate me. I just believe that in complete disgust, he had just quit. And I was alone. I was afraid to go near the altar 6 days a week. I said Mass on Sunday because of the obligation. I was scared to say Mass. I used to get down to morning meditation and go up to my room and lie on my back on my bed staring at the ceiling. I mean, we know that no man is an island. We aren't alone. There is a God who loves us. But I just felt abandoned. I felt that when I died, I'd be in orbit somewhere, alone. And one day this beautiful, gentle man, who was truly a father to me, called me up. I thought, "God help us, what's he got on me now? What's he going to say to me? What is it now?" And instead of making me come to see him, he drove over to St. Charles College to see me. And he said, "Son, we're sending you away this summer. Now this isn't punitive, I just want you to be well. 98% of my problem left me." And on June the 15th, 1958, I entered guest house. I walked in the front door and met Austin Ripley. Now, I don't know whether you have anyone like this in your life or not, but if you don't, find one. A hero. Somebody to look up to. Within 5 minutes of being in that man's presence, I wanted to be just like him. God, I wanted everything he had. And for those reasons, I would have died to please him. I've seen some of the most brilliant minds in the United States follow him around like puppies. I can't define charisma, but I know when I'm near it, and he had it. AA tells us that we must place principles before personalities, but never instead of them. You see, principles don't exist except within the human heart. It wasn't the 12 steps printed in the big book that saved my life. You could have mailed the big book to me before I got into guest house. I could have read it and died drinking. It was a man who saved my life. It was the 12 steps printed on his soul that made me want to be like him. You know what the treatment at guest house was? Old Doc Green used to give a series of talks explaining what was wrong with us. Nice to know what you're sick with, so you know what it is you're getting well from. And he told us about alcoholism, and I took notes, and that's what became the Chalk Talk. And Rip explained AA step by step. This man came into AA 1 year after that big book was written. He came in 1940. Took a solid year of his life off to get to know Bill and Dr. Bob. I believe he had as much influence on them as they did on him, and I had his influence for 7 months. I like to boast inside myself that I got my sobriety secondhand from Bill and Dr. Bob through Rip. Not 100,000th hand, secondhand. Every conviction in my soul about sobriety, about the disease, about this program, about that big book came from him. And those convictions have become mine. One is the absolute necessity of a good sponsor. Why in the name of God we wanted to function, or we functioned alone when we were drinking, why we want to function alone sober is absolutely beyond me. No one is judge in his own case. If popes have confessors and presidents have cabinets, who the hell do I think I am that I can direct my own life? I remember once a young woman up in Albany, New York. I'd given a talk on the guidelines for helping alcoholics. And she came up to me afterwards in tears. Oh, she says, I want to thank you so much. I said, for what? She said, well, you've inspired me to stay with my job. I was ready to quit. I said, what is your job? She said, I'm a counselor, alcoholism counselor. I said, how old are you? She said, 26. I said, 26 is rather young for wanting to quit a job that you've spent a few years trying to get. Why do you want to quit? She said, burnout, I guess. I said, who's your counselor? And she stared at me. How dare any of us look at another human being and say, you need me, but I don't need anybody. Why do we go to meetings? It's because you're there. It's because examples of sobriety are there that I can learn from. And I picked the best. You know, I have a treatment center, and over the front door are the words of Bill Wilson. The good is too often the enemy of the best. You know, I've never seen that in a counselor's office, and I've been in hundreds of them. I've seen a lot of seagulls. God, I'm so busy. Seen a lot of philosophical sayings. Dr. Paul, walk in another man's moccasins. Why? 2-1, you'll get athlete's foot. What's the ideal that I want in my sobriety? Not the good, the best. The best. When I settle for what's good, I have settled, and the good becomes a barrier. Or another explanation, margarine may cover the bread, but it ain't butter. Now, what are you worth? I know what I'm worth the best. Do you know there isn't a one of us in this gathering tonight that has a right to be sober? It's a gift. It's a pure gift. I know priests far more talented than I am who deserve this gift much more than... Why me? I don't know. I always say that when I go into treatment centers and talk to patients. A lot of you are wondering, why me? I can't ever drink again. Why me? I gotta be here. Why me? I say, for every one of you, there are gonna be a whole bunch of people out there gonna die. So when you go to bed tonight, get on your knees and ask God, why me? Why am I being given a chance to live? I don't know. I don't know why he picked me. Don't know why he picked you, but he did. Evidently, there's something in there that he wants to polish up and shine up so that it'll be of use to him. So we go through this program, and Rip taught us the steps. And we try to do 12 things to change our lives. You know what Bill Wilson's definition of sobriety is? The spiritual awakening he speaks of in step 12? Somebody asked him one day, I said, what do you mean by that? He said, look for a profound change in personality. Rip used to always say, look for the man or woman who would have been if alcohol had never entered his life. I always say, plus the added dimension that suffering brings to a human life. Step one, give in, or you'll cave in. One or the other. The paradox of the alcoholic was just read. You know the paradox of sobriety? We have to surrender to gain a victory. We surrender to win. That goes against every principle of military technique and strategy known. You know, if we don't get in the ring, we can't get beat up. If you don't take a drink, you can't get drunk. But you know what we bring in people? You know, some jackass once said, we alcoholics are cut above average intellectually. Well, God. Jeez, there's so many of us, there's got to be a brain out there somewhere. But you know what used to stump us brilliant people when we were drinking? Get a load of this insurmountable problem. How to get rid of empty bottles. Geez, a kid would look you right in the eye and say, throw them out. Too simple. Too simple. You know what we brilliant people used to do in the drinking days? Climb into the ring with a champion and get beat up every day, and we keep doing it. Keep doing it. Keep doing it. After 16 years, all black and blue, we're crawling toward the ring, putting the gloves on, wondering, how can I not get beat up today? And a little kid leans over your shoulder and says, don't get in the ring, dummy. Oh. If you don't take a drink, you can't get drunk. And so if I don't fight booze, I have no problem with it. But the problem is that I can't not fight it. I'm compelled to get in the ring. So I have to surrender and acknowledge that fact. I'm helpless. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives have become unmanageable. God, alcohol controlled 90% of my waking thought. Dictated the people I like to associate with. Dictated the restaurants I went into and those I stayed away from. Life was manageable. You may have been able to read a book or write a book or teach a class or run a company. But I mean, when it dictates all your other behavior, all of our behavior was toward obtaining and consuming something we couldn't exist without. I came to believe I could get well by looking at other people that did. Since they were helpless and didn't have the power in themselves, they had to reach outside. I came to the conclusion I had to do the same thing. Get in touch with this power greater than myself. God. Step one, I can't handle it. Step two, I see that God can. Step three, I think I'll get in touch. What do we mean by let go and let God? Ladies and gentlemen, I believe that the love of God is like the love of humans for each other. Real love is not, of course, in the beginning, the chemistry attraction, it's like magnets, you know. But it doesn't go on that way. Love is not so much two people gazing into each other's eyes all the time. You do that long enough, one of you is bound to puke. Real love is two people gazing in the same direction. The love of God's the same thing. I don't have to feel anything. He said, if you love me, keep my rules. So I find out what God's will is for me, and I make my will conform to it. What's God's will for me? Get sober and stay sober by using the means I put on this earth. Oh. So when I conform my will to this plan of sobriety that he has given me, I've accepted his will. I place myself under his care. That is his care for me. But as children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I brought my broken dreams to God because he was my friend. But then instead of leaving him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last I snatched them back and cried, how could you be so slow? My child, he said, what could I do? You never did let go. And so hanging on to our own way of doing things certainly got us into trouble. I found, you see, I was not in denial. I really did know what was wrong with me, and whatever Rip said, I'd have done. I'm not making this up. If he had said, during your first month here, I want you to sleep on the floor, at 3 o'clock every afternoon, you'll blow your nose, I'd have done it. But I'd have done it without question. I wouldn't even have asked him why. Find somebody like that in your life whose judgment you trust beyond doubt. And if you have the willingness, you've got it made. Greatest piece of advice I ever had. He told me the afternoon I arrived. He said, Father, I know all about your education, your background. Your brains didn't work, did they? I said, of course not. He said, Padre, you don't need brains to get well. Leave them right outside the door. We need desire to get well. And the ability to count to 12. I have seen brilliant people die of this disease. Their brains really did get in their way. I've seen illiterates with magnificent sobriety. Rip used to tell us that AA is the greatest university on earth. It's where priests learn from plumber how to live. But Dr. Bob beautifully summarized our whole program in 6 words. Trust God, steps 1, 2, and 3. Clean house, steps 4 through 11. Help others, step 12. The paradox of the alcoholic you just heard, the paradox of recovery, Bill Wilson had to start with the 12th step in order to learn the first 11. We have to work the first 11 to have this awakening as a result of those steps in order to qualify to give something to others. I found that the middle steps of AA were like self-surgery without an anesthetic. To want to ask God to remove faults that I have spent a lifetime acquiring. I love them. To do the hard things. As I get older, I don't want to do hard things. We're always looking for that plateau of peace, some kind of contentment. It's always a month away, isn't it? I believe that there is one main fault with treatment. Of necessity, it's too introspective. All the probing into self and the probing into background and the taking oneself apart and the group therapy and everything. I think a good counselor must never forget that he has to beat into his patients the idea that all of this is meant to equip you to love other people. I wonder if I might not get sober by trying to help another drunk. That is the way it all started. That's the way it all started. Bill didn't have anything to work with. I believe he was inspired to ask that question. And all of treatment, my whole life is geared to helping other people, thereby attaining my own happiness. My friends, let me put it this way. For those of you who have children, what do you want for your children? Don't you want to be good and be happy? You may be a pig, but you want your loved ones to be good. What is the single way of attaining happiness? Being good. Didn't we prove that by doing the opposite? What's the one thing that made me want to be sober more than anything else in the world? Maybe God was good enough to let it happen to you. When I looked into a mirror and just experienced an undeniable, overwhelming desire to vomit because I couldn't stand what I was looking at. I believe that when treatment is all done and a patient leaves with the fear and trembling, fear of his own weakness, fear of the chemical that brought him there, I believe that if blindly he just tries to help somebody else, everything else will fall into place. God, I believe that with a passion. I've seen people you wouldn't bet a nickel on go out and do the job and get sober and stay that way. I've seen people bounce out of treatment with all the enthusiasm in the world, and days later they're in trouble. I hope I never lose my fear of alcohol. I've heard this from the lips of AAs, of some AAs. I don't fear alcohol. I respect it. That's words. That's words. I hope I go to the grave with a very healthy fear that a drink will kill me. God knows what I'll do without it. You know, there are good fears. They're very salutary, solid, healthy, sane fears. One of them is the fear of alcohol. But the big one is my fear of not being as grateful as I should be for what has come my way. I envy people. I've heard this at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of AA meetings. Well, I work these 12 steps to the best of my ability. And I sit there in awe. I don't know whether I've ever worked one of them to the best of my ability. I've never tried even to do two or three things at once, but I just envy people who try to their absolute best to do to all 12 of these things. I think I know what they mean. They're trying their best, but I hear people say how grateful they are, and I cringe almost. You see, gratitude, I have come to learn, is not a feeling. It's an action. The 12th step is gratitude. Rip used to define gratitude as the golden tray on which I offer others what God has given me. I don't have to feel grateful. I have to be grateful. There is a difference. You know the 10 lepers that Christ cured? Don't tell me all 10 didn't feel grateful. You can't have a disease lifted from you and not feel something. One man acted. I think that the 12th step is putting the money where the mouth is. Don't tell me, show me. I somehow, this is my perverted nature, I somehow suspect people who yak about gratitude all the time. I've always said, if you're really grateful, you won't have to say a word. I'll see it. It's trying to carry the message to somebody else, trying to share with somebody else what came my way. Bill Wilson was a man who dreamed the impossible dream, and he fought the unbeatable foe. He bore with unbearable sorrow and ran where the brave dared not go. But he knew if he'd only be true to his glorious quest, that his heart would lie peaceful and calm when laid to its rest. the world has been better for this. One man, scorned, covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage till he reached the unreachable star. And he did, this priceless jewel that you and I call sobriety, the thing men and women in other eras looked for and couldn't find. And the only way we found it is because he found it first and shared it with us. In the process of getting sober, he had had his humanity restored to him because he had been set free from the compulsion to drink alcohol. What is humanity? What is a human? A creature built in the image of God, and so godlike. Since God proved that goodness tends to diffuse itself, that's exactly what Bill Wilson did. I'm going to go home tomorrow. This has been probably the longest month of this year for me. I'm tired right now, I really am. But I'll have some time at home during October. But it's a happy tired. And Jack will bring me to the airport tomorrow morning, and I'll fly on to Chicago and then to Baltimore. Another kind of semi-lonely 6 hours in an airplane. You know, the SOB that designed the airplane seat was roaring drunk at the time. And he hated humans. I believe that the original design is on a bar napkin, and I think it hangs in the Smithsonian over one of the toilets in the men's room. But anyway, it's all that's worth it. But I'll leave here a far richer man than when I came, and I dearly love to come back to Southern California. I always do. I look forward to it. But just let me tell you, Rip, he had marvelous expressions. He was a writer by profession. You just heard an example of it. But he used to say that the tongue is mute when it is faced with the impossible task of expressing the simplest feeling of a heart. If I say, I love you, how in the world can you really know what's in here? You can't explain it. Even when you say I love you to the same person, it means something different every time you say it, doesn't it? But it's one of those things we all think we understand, but I guess the man who comes closest, and I heard him live in concert a couple of years ago in Baltimore, Roger Whittaker, with that absolutely magnificent signature song of his, The Last Farewell. And this is a kind of farewell because I have to say so long until I see you again. For you are beautiful. And I have loved you dearly. More dearly than the spoken word can tell. I hate goodbyes. The Latins always commend you to God. Adios, adieu, addio. And always they look forward to meeting again. I suppose that's the hope that springs eternal in the human breast. Au revoir, Wiedersehen. In Italy, unto the seeing again, arrivedere. In Rome, there is no place on earth where there is more pride of origin. And a Roman always says to another Roman, arrivederci, till we meet again here. If two Romans meet in another part of the world and visit, when they part, they say arrivederla, till we meet again there in Rome. This is where I met you, this beautiful bowl here. Well, I commend you to God, as I always do. Addio. And I hope to God that I see you again here. Arrivederci.
This has been a night to remember for me. I don't know about other people. And it's fantastic. Alcoholics Anonymous in the book put things together in such a way, they also said, if you do these things, you will have an awful lot of good things happen to you. Now, you see a lot of people running around here with these silly badges on. Not too many, but it seems like everybody you see has got a badge on, right? That's because it took an awful lot of people in committees and all that to be helpful in getting this happening. I like that word, happening. The last time we had a happening in Laguna Beach, oh well, that's years ago. I'll explain that to Father Joe later. But I would like just to see the house lights come up so that we can give some thanks to the people who have so generously donated of their time. All of the people you see running around with their badges here, you heard them mention as the gratitude retreat house and a lot of other people here in and around the Laguna Beach area. Most of them are all sitting up in this area, and I would like all of you to please stand and accept my greatest thanks to all of you for being such tremendous, tremendous volunteers. Let me have it. Oh, yes. Because if it wasn't for people like that, this kind of an event couldn't be. Next year, who knows what's coming next year? Except that next year is the 55th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not everybody is going to be able to afford to go to Seattle. So we may decide to throw together something here for the people who can't afford to go to Seattle. How about that? Right? That's not a plug, but it sounds like a good idea. In the book, also, in the chapter Into Action, they put together what have been referred to by many people as the promises. And I would like to say that I've asked Dell if he would once again come out and read for us the promises from the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Starting here.
If we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They're being fulfilled among us sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
I'd like to thank you all for the privilege of being the conductor of this, or the MC. Somebody says he's a mental case, and so I'm a good MC. I'd like to thank the participants. I'd like to thank Ina. I'd like to thank Dr. Paul. I'd especially like to thank Father Joe and Dell for his contribution. I'd like to thank all of you people. And in closing, I would like to thank the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for what it's given us. And if you would, please, in the closing paragraphs of the chapter Revision to You, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. This is the thing that enables me and all of us to say again and again, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Joe, and I'm real pleasure to be here. Would you please, in a moment of silent meditation, while we all say, hey, we're lucky people, would you please join me in the Lord's Prayer? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen. Thank you.
Don't go away. It works better.